This is K-Town. I'm going to take you through some of the most creepy, chilling, and downright terrifying experiences you've ever heard. This is the X Podcast. Listener discretion is advised. There are several areas that are considered when trying to solve the mystery of why kids kill. Severe mental illness can trigger homicide, including bipolar spectrum disorder. If a kid is psychotic, hallucinating, or delusional, they may think something has happened, like aliens invading, or the person killed is doing something to them. Biological factors are also looked at, including brain damage, head trauma, and lower intellectual and emotional functioning, as well as drugs, alcohol, and even fetal alcohol syndrome. Social factors like how you grew up and social messages can be an influence. If you were born in a lower class neighborhood as opposed to a well-to-do neighborhood, even your religious beliefs can play a role. We know these kids are usually very angry. There's always a preoccupation, one psychologist says. They have a higher rate of acting out behavior and oppositional defiance. The family environment can also play a role in why some children are able to kill. If there is violence in the home, there is a certain risk factor. The usual result is kids doing more hitting of other kids in the family and other unrelated kids, as well as attacks on their parents. The single biggest predictor of when kids hit parents is how much the parents are hitting the child under the euphemism of spanking. Some experts even suggest that watching violence on television and in video games promotes aggression in children, although that research is controversial. A West Point military psychologist who trains health professionals on how to prevent killing contends violent programs desensitize children to violence. One former police officer who wrote the book, Stop Teaching Our Kids to Kill, I quote, "I predict that we will soon see more 12-year-olds committing unspeakable crimes like mass murder." Sensational visual images showing hurting as powerful and domination of others as permissible are dangerous. But psychologists are confused why some children cross the line and kill. Why is one child exposed to violence propelled to kill and the other is not? The critical issue in all these factors only affects the person at risk, said one criminal psychologist. A lot of kids watch programs about suicide, but they don't do that. Certain kids are just predisposed to violence. Here are some of those cases. This story is about a young boy named Kip Kinkle. His parents were popular teachers at Springfield, Oregon's two high schools. His sister was a high school valedictorian and a college cheerleader who had won national honors. Yet Kiplin Kip Kinkle had a far more devious claim to fame. He was voted by his high school classmates as most likely to start World War III. It's easy to see where Kip Kinkle's reputation stemmed from. The freckle-faced 15-year-old had a fascination with guns. He had once been arrested for dropping rocks on passing cars from an overpass. He frequently made outlandish statements, usually to the effect that it would be fun to kill someone. Not only that, but this boy was into bomb making and often boasted about torturing and killing animals. As an English literature project, he once stood up in front of class and read an essay about how he built a bomb using instructions downloaded from the internet, and he used it to blow up a cow. William and Faith Kinkle, Kip's parents, tried everything to get help for their troubled son. But despite their extensive experience as school teachers, nothing seemed to work. The boy's problems had been noticeable even before he started first grade. He was a difficult and defiant child. He was prone to temper tantrums when he did not get his own way. At school, he struggled academically, leading his parents to believe that he might be suffering from dyslexia or attention deficit disorder. When tests for both proved negative, they tried helping him with his schoolwork and encouraging him to get involved in leisure pursuits. They took him camping, hiking, sailing, and signed him up for karate and football. Bill, his father, even gave up his teaching career and took early retirement in 1991, just so he can spend more time with his son. But if anything, things got worse. When Kip started getting into fights at school, his parents took him to a private therapist who prescribed Ritalin, then Prozac, and then anger management classes. None of those produced any tangible results. His father then took the extreme step of trying to channel Kip's interest into more productive pursuits. He bought a Ruger 22 caliber pistol and a 22 caliber rifle and encouraged the boy to join a shooting club. Kip went to only one meet before he lost interest. He then demanded a 9mm Glock pistol, which his father eventually gave in and bought for him. A short time later, a neighbor complained that Kip had been firing the pistol in the backyard, and then Bill put his foot down. He locked the guns away in a safe to which he had the only key. The weapons, however, remained in the home, a mistake that would result in tragedy. On the morning of May 20th, 1998, a teacher at Thurston High School got a tip-off that there was a .32 caliber Beretta pistol hidden in locker number 781, Kip Kendall's locker. A search was carried out and the firearm was found just where the tipster said it was. Kip was then marched to the principal's office where he was held until the police arrived. In the interim, Kip's father was called and advised that his son had been suspended pending an inquiry and might end up being expelled. His father, who had taught Spanish at Thurston High School before his recent retirement, fully understood the school's position. He was furious at Kip for doing such a foolish thing. But at least this latest infraction had brought matters to a head. His father was tired of pussyfooting around with his son. It was time for decisive action, and his father knew exactly what he was going to do. It was positively upbeat when he played a game of tennis with a friend that afternoon. Shortly after he got home, Bill made the call he had been thinking about to the Oregon National Guard to inquire about a summer boot camp that they were running for young troubled men like his son. He'd barely hung up the phone when Kip stepped up behind him, raised his semi-automatic Ruger rifle, and pumped a single fatal bullet into the back of his father's head. Bill Kinkle was dead before he even realized he'd been shot. Then Kip dragged his body into the bathroom and sat down to wait his mother's return from her teaching job. When Faith Kinkle stepped out of her car, she found her son standing before her in the garage. "I love you," he said, before raising the rifle and shooting her point blank in the face. Kip, at the age of just 15 years old, was now a double murderer, and he was only getting started. Now, with his parents lying dead downstairs, he spent most of the evening building a series of bombs, which he distributed around the house in various booby traps. Then he watched some television and went to bed like nothing ever happened. He had a big day ahead of him. The next morning, on May 21st, Kip rose early and he went through his usual routine, ate breakfast, and got dressed. But Kip dressed a little differently this time. He added to his ensemble a long trench coat. Next, he loaded up his weapons. He had a 9mm Glock a .22 caliber Ruger, and a .22 caliber rifle, each of them carrying a full clip. Additionally, magazines for weapons were stuffed into his rucksack. A military hunting knife strapped to his ankle complemented the arsenal. Happy with his preparations, Kip got into his mom's Ford Explorer and pointed into the direction of Thurston High School. Kip entered the building just before 8 a.m. and headed directly for the cafeteria, which he knew would be buzzing at that hour. En route, he encountered a student who he advised, "You might want to get out of here." Moments later, he entered the cafeteria and almost immediately flipped back his trench coat to reveal the rifle. Before anyone even had time to cry out, he opened fire, working the room from right to left and then back again, shattering a plate glass window and sparking a stampede of screaming children. 19 students were shot that day, 2 of them fatally, and the body count might have been much higher if it wasn't for a brave young man, 17-year-old Jake Ryder, who was a school wrestling champion, and he had been shot in the hand and in the chest. But he did not hesitate to tackle Kip when he emptied his magazine and stopped to reload. Other male students then joined the fray. They subdued and disarmed Kip. By then, the police and paramedics were already en route, and before long, injured students would be rushed to the nearest hospital. One of them, 17-year-old Michaela Nicholson, was pronounced dead on arrival. 16-year-old Ben Walker would die later of his injuries. Given that Kip had emptied a magazine of 50 rounds, it's a miracle that there weren't more fatalities. Kip had been hauled off for questioning and almost immediately suggested that the police search his parents' house. There they found the corpse of Bill and Faith Kinkle, the parents who had sacrificed so much for their murderous son. Bill had been shot once in the head, while Kip's mother Faith had suffered several wounds to the head and abdomen. Each had been covered with a white sheet, but Kip did not send the police to his house just to find his murdered parents. He rigged the place with explosive devices, no doubt, with the intention of causing further fatalities. One of the bombs did in fact detonate, but it caused no harm. The others were defused by the bomb squad. Back at the station, Kip tried a more direct approach. He still had a hunting knife strapped to his ankle, and he used it to attack a detective. All he got for his troubles was a full face of pepper spray. Kip would ultimately be tried as an adult and found guilty on 4 counts of first-degree murder. On November 10th, 1999, he was sentenced to 111 years in prison without parole. He is currently incarcerated at the Oregon State Correctional Institute in Salem, Oregon. Next is Ricky Casso. Everyone in Northport, Long Island knew that Ricky Casso was crazy. The 17-year-old acid king had done so much LSD, smoked so much angel dust, that it turned his brain to jelly. When he was high, he'd walk deep into the woods outside of town to converse with Satan. He said that the devil appeared to him as a glowing tree. On other occasions, he'd walk to the local cemetery to smoke up. He recently had been arrested for digging up a corpse. No, there was no way you wanted to mess with Crazy Ricky. Gary Lowers found that out the hard way. Gary and Ricky had been friends, fellow dustheads who enjoyed getting stoned together. That was until Ricky passed out at a party and Gary rifled through his pockets and stole 10 bags of angel dust. Problem was that he'd done so in front of witnesses. Ricky later confronted him. He returned 5 of the little yellow envelopes that contained the drugs. He promised to pay for the other 5, but he was slow in doing so. Bad mistake. At first, Ricky resorted to the standard intimidation methods. He tracked Gary down along with his friends, Jimmy and Albert. When they found him, they beat him senseless. When that didn't work, he repeated the remedy 3 more times. Eventually, he threatened to kill Gary if he didn't come up with the money. It was a threat that Gary took very seriously. Soon after, he began telling his friends that Ricky was going to murder him. He started carrying a hunting knife for protection. He also began making a concerted effort to scrape together the $50 that he owed. Eventually, he handed it over, and leading Ricky to call a truce was a few bags of dust compared to a good friend, he told Gary. On the evening of June 16th, 1984, Rick Casso, dressed in an AC/DC t-shirt, was trawling the streets of Northport with Jimmy and Albert, pushing drugs to his teenage clientele, and there were plenty around in those days. School had only recently let out. The Northport teens were in the mood to party. On one of those nights out on the town, Gary Lowers was spotted. Earlier in the evening, Gary had visited a female friend and told her of his plans to quit drugs, finish school, and eventually go to college. By the time he encountered Ricky, Jimmy, and Albert, Gary was high as a kite. When Ricky suggested that they go into the woods to smoke some dust, he readily agreed. After all, hadn't Ricky not forgiven him for his earlier transgression? Had he not paid back the $50? Were he and Ricky not friends? We know what happened in the woods that night only because the testimony of Albert, who agreed to testify against his co-accused at the subsequent trial. According to Albert, the foursome had walked deep into the woods to find a spot to get high. Once they located a suitable place, they took a few hits of the angel dust that Ricky brought along, then decided to build a fire. At this stage, Ricky and Gary were talking and laughing together, just like the friends they'd always been. With a pile of logs and kindling gathered for fire, Ricky tried to get a blaze going, but the wood was damp due to the recent rains and wouldn't ignite. Gary then took off his socks to set them alight, succeeding briefly in getting a small blaze started. This, however, didn't last long. As the flame died, Ricky, in a more menacing tone, suggested that Gary burn the denim jacket he was wearing. "How about I use just the sleeves?" Gary said, removing the jacket. He then produced his hunting knife and hacked the sleeves from the jacket, then set them alight and got a small fire blazing. But this, too, was soon reduced to embers. And Rick then suggested that Gary cut off some of his hair and throw it in the fire. The tension now, despite the drugs they had taken, was very obvious. Gary got slowly to his feet, seemingly ready to flee at any moment. "I have funny vibes that you're going to kill me," he said. "What?" Ricky responded. "Are you crazy? I'm not going to kill you." And perhaps up until that moment, he hadn't really considered killing Gary. Perhaps Gary's premonition was what actually triggered the attack. Whatever the case, Ricky suddenly launched himself at his friend. He was bigger and stronger, given additional strength by the angel dust he'd taken. Still, Gary put up a valiant fight. As they rolled on the ground, he broke free and made a run for it, gaining a few yards before Jimmy tackled him to the ground. Then Ricky was on top of him, using his teeth to tear at his victim, ripping a chunk of flesh from his throat, severing an earlobe. Meanwhile, Jimmy joined the attack, using his boots on Gary's ribs. Still, Ricky wasn't done. Retrieving Gary's hunting knife from the ground, he began stabbing him, inflicting several deep wounds. Then he pulled his helpless victim to his feet. "Say you love Satan," Ricky demanded, speaking directly into Gary's bloody face. "I love my mother," Gary rasped, something that appeared to infuriate Ricky. He launched another attack with the knife, stabbing Gary. again and again, inflicting a total of 32 wounds to his chest, neck, and face. Eventually, he allowed his victim to slump to the forest floor. But Gary was not dead yet, and neither was his suffering over. Before he eventually expired from his horrendous injuries, Ricky inflicted some more. Gary was burned, slashed across the face, and his eyes gouged. Death, when it came, must have seemed like mercy. Ricky and Jimmy then dragged the body deeper into the woods, covered it with leaves, and walked away. In the aftermath of the murder, Ricky and Jimmy fled to Saratoga Springs, fearing arrest. But Gary was a habitual runaway, and his friends and family assumed that he had hit the road again. No one reported him missing. The only person who knew about the murder was Albert, and he stayed in town. Ricky phoned him a couple of days later, and Albert told him there was no heat over Gary's disappearance. Ricky and Jimmy decided to come back to Northport, and they might have gotten away with murder had Ricky been able to keep his mouth shut. The Acid King was keen to impress his teenage hanger-ons. He began boasting about the murder he committed in the name of Satan, and he even added some embellishments, insisting that he heard a crow call at the moment of Gary's death. This, he said, was a sign from Satan, giving his approval for the murder. It was a tale that Ricky told several times over the weeks that followed. If anyone expressed doubts about his story, he invited them into the woods to view Gary's decomposing remains. A number of Northport teenagers took him up on his offer, tramping deep into the woods to satisfy their morbid interest. And yet, remarkably, not one person went to the authorities. It was only when a friend of Gary's heard the stories that the truth finally came out. After receiving an anonymous tip, the police sent canine units into the woods on July 4th, 1984. It wasn't long before the dogs picked up the scent of death, and investigators walked up on Gary's badly decomposed corpse. The notches clearly visible on the exposed rib cage left no doubt as to how he died. Ricky, Jimmy, and Albert were taken into custody on July 5th. Under questioning, Ricky had no problem admitting to the murder. In fact, he did so in such an upbeat tone that investigators should perhaps been concerned about his state of mind. He should probably have been placed on suicide watch. Instead, he was returned to his cell, where on July 7th, 2004, Ricky hanged himself. His co-accused Jimmy was later acquitted of second-degree murder. The aftermath of Gary Lauer's murder brought forth wild speculations about his occult connections. There was also speculation that Ricky was influenced by the love of heavy metal music, especially the satanic lyrics of his favorite band, AC/DC. The truth is that Ricky Casso was the classic case of a young life lost to addiction. He'd once been a bright student and a talented athlete, but his involvement in drugs had put an end to all that. It had also led him down the path to murder. Next, Carl Newton Mahan. The town of Paintsville sits among steep hills in the coal mining belt of eastern Kentucky. It has never been a prosperous place, and it was far from prosperous in 1929 when our story takes place. The stock market crash that would usher in a great recession across America was still months away. But for the good folk of Paintsville, the hard times had already arrived. Hewing coal from the pit mine is a tough living at best, especially when the mine owners didn't appreciate the men doing the tough and dangerous work. The coal miners of Kentucky are the hardy breed, accustomed to backbreaking work and crushing poverty. They make do with what they can earn by their own efforts, and that trait extends even to their own children. Take Carl Mahan and Cecil Van Hose, for example. The boys were already trying to make their way in the world, in their case, by searching for scrap metal to sell. Thus, it was on that morning of May 18th, 1929, they found themselves trudging up a hillside, casting around for a rusty treasure. The pickings had been decidedly slim that day, until Carl spotted a large chunk of pig iron in the scrub grass. It was a valuable find, worth a few pennies at least from the local scrap dealer. Carl quickly unfurled the burlap bag he was carrying and prepared to load it up. That was when his older, bigger companion stepped up and snatched his prize away. Carl, of course, protested the theft, citing the finder's keeper's rule. But Cecil wasn't about to listen to his protest, not when there were a few valuable pennies involved. He delivered a slap to Carl's head to back him off. Then he snatched up the chunk of iron and walked away. But Cecil made a grave mistake, stealing from his young companion. Even as he walked towards the scrap dealer to cash his bounty, Carl was running downhill towards the shack he shared with his parents and siblings. There, he pulled a chair towards the wall where his father's shotgun was racked. Standing on tiptoes, he removed the 12-gauge from its resting place. His father had already shown him how to use the weapon, and so he instinctively broke the breech and checked that there were shells loaded in the twin barrels. Happy that his weapon was armed, Carl set off in pursuit of his thieving friend. A short while later, he encountered Cecil in the street. Bystanders who witnessed the incident will later testify that Carl made little effort to disguise his intentions. He simply shouted out, "I'm going to shoot you," and then lifted the weapon and fired, hitting Cecil right in the chest. The boy was dead before he ever hit the ground. Justice moved swiftly in those days, and Carl became the youngest ever homicide defendant in Kentucky's history. Less than a week after he shot Cecil Van Hose, Carl Mahan found himself in front of a judge, charged with murder. Carl made no effort to deny what he had done. That would be pointless anyway, since the shooting occurred in front of witnesses, and he made no pretense as to his motive. He intended to kill Cecil, he said, because Cecil had stolen from him. Then, after describing the events leading up to the shooting and the shooting itself, the skinny little kid with a cowlick put his head down on the defense table and promptly fell asleep. Looking at his angelic face, it was difficult to believe that this was a murder defendant. The trial of Carl Mahan was a brief affair, concluding within the space of a single day, and the jury deliberations were shorter still. Within just 30 minutes, the foreman announced that they had reached their decision. Carl Mahan was found not guilty, but guilty of a lesser charge of manslaughter. The sentence of the court was that he was to be sent to reform school for 15 years. In the meanwhile, he was released into the custody of his parents on a $500 bail. But the trial and the verdict provoked furious debate in Johnson County, and already the battle lines were drawn. On one side, there were those that believed that Carl could not understand the implications of his actions because he was so young and therefore should not be convicted. They felt that a 15-year sentence was way too harsh. On the other, there were those that held that manslaughter was way too lenient, and that Carl should have been charged and convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison. There were even less charitable souls who insisted that he should have been put to death in the electric chair. In the end, though, all of those arguments were academic. Shortly after the conclusion of the trial, a circuit court judge issued a writ of prohibition, blocking the state from sending Carl to reform school. A month later, Kentucky's Attorney General set aside the conviction and the sentence, allowing the boy to remain under his parents' supervision without restrictions. Kentucky's youngest ever convicted murderer had escaped punishment entirely. There is little information about Carl's life as an adult. What is known is that he later moved to Jefferson County and died there in 1958 at the age of 35. At the time of the murder, Carl was only 6 years old. That's it for this edition. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes. This is K-Town, and I'll see you next time on The X Podcast.